Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Raven Review Discussion Series, a product of the Raven Foundation. The Raven Review is an online magazine at ravenfoundation.org, where you can find all kinds of articles and interviews on mimetic theory, religion, pop culture, politics, and family life. But today, I am so excited because we have my good friend Safi Kaskus on the show. Hi, Safi.
Hi. Hi, Adam.
It's good to see you, and thanks for being here.
Thank you.
We had a little bit of a problem getting a good time to have this interview because you're in Saudi Arabia, where it's 6 o'clock p.m., right?
Yes. I just prayed my sunset prayer.
Oh, fantastic.
Oh, yes.
How does the sunset prayer go? Can you pray?
Yes. As a matter of fact, before I go to prayer, I have to do ablution. Before every prayer, I do ablution. That means I wash my hands, my mouth, my nose, my face, my arms, all the way to the elbow. And then I wash the front head, the ears, the neck, and my feet. And then this is not necessarily for cleanliness only, but water has a spiritual aspect for Muslims. That's why baptism is important. So yeah. I do ablution, and then I start my prayer by reciting Al-Fatiha, which is like the Lord's Prayer, kind of. We say this prayer in every prayer we do. This is the ritual prayer, of course, and I'm facing the Kaaba, facing Mecca, facing the Kaaba, and I'm reading Al-Fatiha, then I read another short surah, and I repeat that. For sunset, we call them three portions, three bowing downs, three rak'ah in Arabic, and that constitute the sunset prayer. The last prayer would be the one after that, comes about an hour and a half from now. And hopefully we'll be done by then.
Well, it is 6 o'clock your time and 7 a.m. here in Oregon. But I have my coffee and
good,
I am
good
to go. So let's do this. Jefferson Slinger.
The motor.
Jefferson says hello. So we've already got people in the comments. So this will be a great conversation. So before we start, I want to let the people in the audience know that we have a chat section, and if anybody wants to make comments or questions, they can make them there, and Suzanne will come in and tell us about those comments and questions. So Suzanne, feel free to come in anytime. So Safi, I wanted to give people a little introduction of you. You are a businessman, a trained businessman, who has turned to kind of spreading the message of Islam through your books on the Quran and through social media. And I thought this was fascinating because it follows the pattern of the Prophet Muhammad, who was a businessman and then turned to spreading religion, right?
In a sense, yes. My mission is not to spread the Islam, but my message is to spread, at this time, reconciliation. Yeah. I try to be a good ambassador of my Prophet Muhammad, and if someone wants to follow that example, it's up to them. But as far as I'm concerned, I don't encourage people to convert. Conversion is not necessarily something important to me. It's between whoever is listening, watching, and their creator. If they want to follow a certain path, it's up to them. It's part of the freedom to choose.
This is one of the things that people seem to be misunderstanding and questioning about Islam a lot these days, is whether or not Islam tries to force conversion on people. And this is against the freedom that you're talking about in Islam.
Well, in fact, it should be. Look, Islam is the name of religion, of a religion right now. and Muslims are the followers. But we're talking about 1.6 billion people, and we're talking about 60 different countries. Mm-hmm. So it's not, I think, very wise for me to generalize and to talk about what Islam requires and what Muslims do. Islam is one thing. Muslims are another thing. Mm-hmm. And Muslims in Indonesia are one thing, and Muslim in Egypt are another thing, because they're different cultures, different influences, and people, follow whatever they feel that it will help them worship their Lord the best way possible. Mm-hmm. So basically, the Quran, we can talk about the Quran, because mm-hmm. it's a book that's common to the 1.6 billion Muslims. Not necessarily that they all read it and understand it. Only the intellectuals among those people can read and understand. A lot of them read it and don't understand it. But as far as I am concerned, the Quran forbid forced conversion. It warned Muslim against forced conversion. It doesn't allow it. The essence of the Quran is freedom. And we can talk about that a whole lot more. I can talk about it with a little bit of authority, because I went over every single word of the Quran in Arabic, understood it, tried to find an equivalent meaning in English. So I can say that I understand what is in that book, what is the essence of the book, what is the essential message of the book. So, we can talk about that anytime you want.
That's good. I want to talk about your two translations of the Quran in a little bit. But I've known you for about 2 years on social media, and I always appreciate your deep faith and love for Islam. And as a Christian, it deepens my faith and inspires me. And I'd love to know, what is it about Islam that inspires you?
Adam, actually, I'm inspired by my Creator. I'm not inspired by any particular message. The message is something to guide someone on earth to the best way to be a good servant. My Creator gave me consciousness, which is unique to creatures on earth. So I can think, I can reason, I can realize that He's there. And if if I'm a wise person, I will either choose to worship Him, or I choose not to worship Him. Well, the problem is, if I don't worship Him, there is only one alternative. I'll be worshiping myself. Each one of us that decide not to worship God is in fact worshiping himself. So that's what impresses me, basically. What I'm impressed with my Creator, the creation that surround me, my own creation. He told me in the Quran to look within me and around me in the universe. And it's all His words and His miracles all around, within and without.
Yeah, I'm often struck we will either worship ourselves, or we'll worship other human beings and elevate them above where they should be, as we often do with ourselves too. And this is one of the important messages of monotheism. In the Quran, there is one God, and it's not you.
Yes, exactly. Adam, actually, the essential message in the Quran is the same as in the Torah and in the scriptures. Remember the Shema, O Israel, the Lord God is one. So basically, all of these Abrahamic religion have one essential message. There is a Creator. That Creator is one. Mm-hmm. So for us to realize this, I'll go back to my main theme. It's really you hit on the main theme of my own life. I'm proposing that any time of the day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, I'm making decisions. And those decisions would have one of two purposes. either I'm doing them to please my creator, and I'll do that through serving others, or I'm doing them to serve my own selfishness, my own ego. And then instead of serving others, I'll climb on others, I'll step on others, I will abuse others. There is no other way. It's one of two choices. I can't see any third one, basically, all day long. So I came to a conclusion, I want to worship my creator. So that turned me into a servant, because the Quran teaches me, as well as Jesus taught us, as well as the Torah taught us, if you want to get close to this creator, there is one path, to serve others. And, you know, I'm a servant. I basically like to call myself a servant. And this is why I work for reconciliation. And this is why I choose not to be a victim in the United States to the Islamophobes. That's why I don't let them scapegoat me. I run away from that because I'm a free man. You know, my master is much bigger than all of them. And I serve him. I don't serve anybody else.
How do you, there's so many questions that I have right now. How do you, there is all kinds of fear that people have about Islam. I mean, even when I'm posting, publishing this on Facebook and inviting people to join, there are all kinds of people who write and say all of these really nasty things about Islam. And I think, you know, Donald Trump says there's something going on with that religion and just kind of foments this fear. And you say you're not a victim of it. You're not going to allow them to scapegoat you. How do you manage your, how do you manage yourself in this situation so that you're not a victim?
Well, simply because I know my purpose on earth. I'm not here accidentally. I'm not here to be a victim. I'm here basically to serve. I'm here to love my creator and to love my neighbors. So once you have that conviction, not lip service, but conviction, once you know that this is your purpose on earth, that, and you're going to be here for a short while, I'm 73 now. So, you know, what's left is not as much as what's already went by. So it's easier for me to focus and to know that the only thing I want to do here is to bring peace between warring factions. So instead, look, the Arabs scapegoat what they perceive as an enemy. Whether this is the United States or whether it's Israel, if you're living in the Middle East or whatever, we like to put the blame on that other who we know all this. And but in the United States, this is not going to solve any problems. If I fall into that game, then maybe some people will be relieved if they feel like they crushed me. But then after that, the problem would remain there. Their problem is to believe in pluralism, is to believe in the essential principles of the Constitution of the United States. If they really want to be Americans, they have to know that that citizenship is not an easy thing. They have to sacrifice a lot in order to earn it, in order to live up to the expectation of their own Constitution.
Yeah.
I mean, these are the things that motivate me. And in my mind, this is what keeps me going.
I love it. A lot of times, you have just inspired something in me that makes me love the United States. Makes me love the Constitution.
Well, I chose to be an American. I wasn't born in the United States. See, I chose to be an American because the potential of greatness is there. We have what people yearn for. We have a great constitution. We have freedom of expression. We have freedom to practice our religion. People don't understand how important that is for healthy human being to live their life. People are dying in Halab. I hope you know where Halab is.
Where is Halab?
Aleppo.
Yes.
Remember
Aleppo,
that. Remember that guy that didn't know where Aleppo is.
Yep.
You know where Aleppo is. People are dying there because there is no guarantee for their freedom. They don't have the right to elect their president. I was in the United States when, right before the election. I went and casted my vote in Fairfax, Virginia. I cried because I exercised a right that hundreds of thousands of people yearn for, hope for, wish for, and don't have that right. And I just went simply and told the lady there, I want to vote. So I voted. Well, my candidate didn't win. Didn't bother me. I just simply accepted the results. And because this is democracy. I mean, there is no sense in crying over spelled whatever. It's right. This is democracy. You have to accept the results. And if I don't agree with a particular candidate, all I have to do is work hard. So the second time around, I'll have my candidate to win. It's that simple. So we're divided really over nothing. United States need to be united at this time. And United States is the white people, the Caucasians, the black, the minorities, the Muslims, the Christians, the Jews, the Buddhists, everybody. We are all Americans. This is what makes United States great. So if people understand this, they'll move forward instead of looking backward and crying over that results that they wasn't to their liking.
I love it. I love it. When you bring up the Constitution, a lot of people are afraid of Sharia. There are a lot of people are afraid that Muslims want to come in and replace the Constitution with Sharia. And it seems like it's a buzzword that people are using, but they don't really know what it is or what it means. So what is Sharia?
Again, this is scapegoating. Sharia is nothing. Sharia is nothing we need to worry about, because all the Muslims in the United States are no more than 1% of the population. How would they enforce anything over the rest of the population? The last time we tried to amend the Constitution in the United States was for the Equal Right Amendment. Women got together, all the open-minded men backed them up, the whole world probably was with them, and after it passed Congress, it wasn't implemented because we couldn't get the states to ratify it. So it is impossible to change the Constitution. Beside that, having said that, 1% cannot force its will over 99%. Having said that, let me tell you something about Sharia. Most of those people that are talking about Sharia don't know what they're talking about. Sharia is not what's implemented in Saudi Arabia, because that's Saudi Arabia. Sharia is not what's implemented in Sudan, because that's Sudan. Sharia is not what's implemented in Pakistan. Sharia is basically how a Muslim lives his life. What I described to you about performing my prayer and doing ablution, I did all that according to Sharia. I basically did what Prophet Muhammad used to do, and because I follow him, I try to get closer to God through the ways he taught me. I implemented Sharia there. See, there is no such thing, by the way, called Sharia in Islam. Sharia is not in the Quran. Sharia is not part of the Sunnah. Sharia is what came later on by scholar who tried to put all this together to describe to a common Muslim how to live his life. So that definition alone will tell you it's time and place sensitive. Any Muslim now, and a lot of Muslims don't understand Sharia, any Muslim that doesn't understand that Sharia is time and place sensitive, he doesn't know his religion. He need to go back and read and learn and understand that nothing is forever except God. God is the only thing that's forever. Everything else changes. So the teachings of the Quran about law are time and place sensitive. The second Khalifa, Omar, stopped cutting the hand of the thieves because they had hunger at that time. And he thought, unless everybody has enough money to buy food, and beyond that, they try to go and steal, then maybe we need to start by asking them to go and clean the bathrooms in the mosque for 3 weeks. If they do it 10 times after that, then maybe they need a punishment. And if we live in a developing state that need both hands of all its workers, then this is good enough reason not to implement that, because the state need people to work. The state doesn't need people to burden it. So all this is time and place sensitive. Nothing is carved in stone. All this is a scare tactic to scare the American people and tell them the enemy is the Muslims, when in fact the Muslims are serving United States in every state. They're doctors, they're engineers, they're teachers, they're in every field. They're businessmen. I worked very hard to make my money. Nobody gave me my money. I worked very hard. When I came to the United States, though, I had only $76 in my pocket. If I made money, it's because my neighbors welcomed me to start with. Nobody was scared of me. They welcomed me. Their doors were always open. They always invited me to their churches and to their homes. And I'm forever appreciative of this. If it wasn't for my neighbors' love, I wouldn't have made it. So I worked hard. I made money. I opened many companies. I served the United States to the best of my ability. And then I thought the things I learned over there, I will transfer and help some other Arabs with it, because they need help. They need technology transfer. So this is but basically that's why I'm here. You know, I did a lot of startups in the state. I did a lot of startups in Saudi Arabia for Saudis, not for myself.
Yeah.
Adam. Yes. Adam and Safi, excuse me for interrupting the flow, but there's a couple of questions in the chat room that I just want to raise, and you can get to them when when you want to do it. One question is about explaining the difference between Sunni and Shia practice, and especially about Iran. What do people in Iran believe? Yes. And then the other question is about a recent recording that from a nominee for the National Security Agency saying that Islam is not a religion, but it's a political movement that seeks world domination. Yeah. So the question is about explaining the relationship between Islam and politics.
Yes. Adam, I suggest that I will be brief, if you don't mind. This way we can take more questions.
Sure.
When Prophet Muhammad was alive, he was running the state of Medina. He was invited by the people of Medina to govern over them. And he did that. When he died, Muslim elected his first successor. Now, some Muslims thought that somebody else, the son-in-law of Brother Muhammad and his cousin, is more worthy of leading the Muslims, especially that he lived all his life with the Prophet. The Prophet, in a sense, trained him. You know, he was with him all the time. They lived literally next door to each other. So anyway, and that did not happen. So then when the first successor died, the second successor was elected. Then the third. And the fourth one was this person that some Muslim thought he ought to be the first successor, and his name is Ali. Now, all Muslims respect Ali very, very much. And we all Muslims think that he deserved to be a successor, the Khalifa, the governor of that state. But unfortunately, some other people decided to fight him. And from that time on, Muslims were split. And actually, he lost his seat through a trick that wasn't really a very nice trick. Somebody tricked him into into just leaving, you know, the governorship. And somebody else was elected. And from that day on, the Muslim state became an empire. From that day on, it started expanding. It started going to places that were not a threat to the young states, just to conquer them. And I didn't find anywhere in the Quran that says that we should go to other places to attack them unless they are a threat to the young states. So the Quran insists that you're not allowed to fight unless you're defending yourself. Anyway, now let me go back to the Shia and the Sunni. The young empire became the empire of the Sunnis, basically. And the Shia became an underground movement. That underground movement later on developed and developed an ideology. That ideology would say the only people sanctioned to lead Muslims are those that are descendant from the Prophet. While the rest of the empire, before it became an empire, thought that a leader should be elected. Now, the first empire was the Umayyad dynasty. The second empire became the Abbasite dynasty, and so on. Those dynasties ended with the Ottoman recently, after World War I. Okay, now you have Muslims in post-World War II living in fragmented states that used to be one state at one time. You have Syria, Iraq, Iran. You know, all these were one huge state at one time and then became fragmented. Iran became a Shia state. It has rivalries with all the Sunni states. That rivalry is mostly political, and it's over political influence. Of course, people, like you know very well, when they scapegoat others, they try to say, we're on the side of what's right. God is on our side. So the other is the enemy and the other is evil. So both sides are saying the same thing about each other at this time. But basically, let me tell you what they both believe. Both believe in the same God, oneness of God. Both believe in the same book, the Quran. Both believe that Muhammad is the prophet. And beyond that, they are fighting a political, nasty war. So far, it's a cold war. It can become a hot war later on.
Yeah, it's also strange to me when talk about scapegoating, when politicians or people think that Muslims are out to conquer the world, and the United States, I mean, we've got military bases all over the world. So it's kind of, there's a bit of projection in that, it seems to me.
Well, I mean, so, you said it. I mean, you anybody that is wondering whether Muslims have the ability at this time, maybe at one time they did. I mean, yeah. Look, the Quran teach me to say the truth, even if it's against myself or my own family. Yep. The minute the Muslims start building an empire, the same thing that happened to the Christian when Constantine became a Christian happened to the Muslims. And mm-hmm. I will tell you right now, from studying history, instead of being the meek movement, the movement of the poor, the movement of the weak people, Christianity at that time became aggressive. Yep. Unless you believe in the four canonized Bible, we're going to burn your books. We're going to punish you and all. Same thing happened with Muslims. The minute the Islam became an empire, the whole thing, you know, lost its spirituality. It becomes political, you know. So yep. What we're trying to do right now, some people are trying to go back to the purity of that message. This is why in my translation of the Quran, I don't translate Islam as a noun. I translate it as a verb. And that's very important, because the Quran teaches that the only religion accepted by God is Islam. If you translate it as a noun, you'll be building a wall around all those who call themselves Muslims. But if you translate it like the first Arabs heard it when it was first said, it wasn't meant to identify a group of people with a certain faith. It meant those who submit to God. So I translate it as such. So now, anybody, you, your audience, everybody in the United States, in Europe, if they say that they believe in one God, they can be considered Muslims in my book, in my own conscience. I don't have neither to fight with them for any reason, nor to have enmity with them for any reason. They're my neighbors and my brothers.
They're Muslim in the sense that they try to
submit to God,
the will of God, which is, as you started off saying, to serve your fellow
humans. Yes.
Yeah.
To serve others.
Yeah.
God doesn't need for me to serve him. God wants me to serve his other creatures. So if I am a servant, like Jesus said, if you want to be first, you have to be last. So, I mean, serving others is very simple. In the United States, we turned it into a science. It's called servant leadership, you know? So people need to learn this and follow it. This was the first question that Suzanne asked. What was the second question?
Oh, right. What was the second question, Suzanne? It was, we did Sharia, the Sunni and the Shia split, and then
it was Sharia. You kind of answered it, Safi, about the relationship between Islam and politics. The question was
Islam and yeah. See, I have a list of verses from the Quran that urges Muslims not to fight unless they are protecting themselves. It's self-defense only. You know, during the time of Prophet Muhammad, in order to fight, well, let me back off a little bit. See, people understand Islam as if it is Prophet Muhammad in Medina and he's fighting. Well, Islam didn't start like this. Islam started when Prophet Muhammad was 40 years old. Before that, he was a merchant and he was in Mecca. And for 13 years, he called the idol worshippers to forsake worshiping idols and to worship the God of Abraham, the one true creator who created them and the universe they live in. So during that time, for 13 years, he was fought, persecuted, hurt. His followers were killed. They were kicked out of town. They saw all kind of punishment. And at that time, neither the prophet nor his followers had permission to fight back. So he did not even lift a finger to defend himself. And his followers were told to be patient, regardless what kind of torture they are experiencing, until some of them couldn't take it anymore. And you know what Prophet Muhammad did? He told them, there is a Christian king in Abyssinia, which is Ethiopia today, where you can have a safe haven. So he sent them to a Christian king. They went over there and they lived peacefully. Later on, after 13 years of pain, of suffering, he was invited by the people of Medina. Its name wasn't Medina at that time. It was Yathrib. He was invited to come and lead the two tribes that make the population of that town. Those two tribes were fighting for hundreds of years, and they wanted someone who is known to be a fair person, a just person, who will govern over them justly. So they came to Muhammad, and they had a covenant with him to come and lead them. Now, that young state, it's a state. The people where Muhammad was living in Mecca didn't leave him alone because he left. He was still a threat. So they formed armies and chased him. So either he would fight as a leader of a new state, or he would lay over and play dead and let them walk all over the new state. Running a state is not like being a prophet or a messenger. It's another story altogether. So Muhammad was a prophet and a messenger and also a head of a state. And as a head of a state, he had to fight only to defend himself, only after he received permission from God to fight. There is a verse in the Quran that says, permission was granted for those that are oppressed to fight back. So this is when the fight started.
It's interesting. Yes, self-defense. It's interesting to me because whenever people criticize the Quran for being violent and they point to these violent verses, they take those verses out of context. And I know this is part of what you're trying to do in your translation of the Quran, is to keep everything in its historical and literary context. So when they point to these violent verses, they omit the ending of them, which always end up saying something like, if they stop hostilities, you must stop hostilities. If they ask for peace, you must give them peace.
Yes.
So it's always geared towards this end of peace.
Yes. End of hostility to establish peace.
Yes.
And then there is, after, you know, then there is this famous verse of the Quran that everybody quote, and about, you know, chase them and kill them anywhere you find them and all of that. This, I have it here, and I have exactly what it says in the Quran about it. If people simply read the verse before it and the verse after it, it'll become all very clear, and they wouldn't need to worry about those violent verses. If you allow me a second, I will read. You know, it's Surah 9, usually verse 5 that they quote, but they didn't mention verse 4, which is before it, or 6 and 7, which is after it. The whole group of verses says, as for those who have honored their treaty obligations, at that time, those that were fighting against Muhammad and the city of Medina signed a treaty with the Prophet. Some of them refused to honor it. As for those who have honored their treaty obligations and have not assisted anyone against you, fulfill your agreement with them to the end of its term. God loves those who are mindful of Him. But once the sacred months are over, there are four sacred months in the Islamic calendar, kill those idolaters wherever you find them, besiege them, ambush them, and imprison them. However, if they repent and pray and pay the prescribed purifying alms, let them go on their way, for God is forgiver and the mercy giver. In other words, they broke the treaty. They are still chasing you, want to kill you. But if they decide to stop, immediately stop and stop fighting them. If any of those idolaters seek your protection, protect him so that he will be able to hear the words of God. For God's sake, he's saying, if they take refuge with you, give them refuge. Take him to a place where he is safe, because they are people who do not know the truth. How can there be a treaty between God and his messenger with the idolaters, except for those with whom you made a treaty at the sacred house? As long as they remain true to you, be true to them. God loves those who are mindful of him. This is the worst verse that Islamophobes like to quote. I'm telling you, anybody that take their time to go and read any translation of the Quran, they're going to find out, they cannot find a verse that asks Muslims to be aggressive, wage war in aggression against other people. If it's not self-defense, it's not sanctioned in the Quran. It's not authorized.
That's why the empire building in Islam because God says God does not love the aggressor, so don't be the aggressor.
Exactly.
And empire building is all about being aggressive.
Yes. I wish we had a lot of time to tell you how that empire started, because that story need to be told. It really need to be told for people to understand. But let me just make the long story short. Suppose those who elected Trump right now have the right to come and sit at the Oval Office with him every day. And then anytime he want to make a decision, they get involved and interfere in the decision. This is what happened at that time. The guy that became the successor, Muawiyah, all those who helped him become the Khalifa, the successor, start coming and sitting with him in his where he make his decision in his I forgot the name of what you call that anyway So they start coming and sitting with him and interfering in. So he formed armies and sent each one of them to a different place to get rid of them, basically. And he found out that this is a profitable business. He's making a lot of money. They're conquering a lot of people. They cannot do it in the name of Islam because you cannot convert these people. So why are you doing it?
Yeah. So we've talked a lot about interpreting the violent texts in the Quran, yes, in their context. Yes. But yes, you have devoted your life to peace and reconciliation. What is it within Islam that leads you to peace and reconciliation?
Well, actually, most of the Quran talk about building peace and reconciliation. You asked me also a question about the Quran being ecumenical.
Yeah.
You know, I also like to, and you asked me also why am I still hopeful about all of this? You know, I have really my reasons, and it's all based on the Quran. Let me read you some of the verses of the Quran that teach us to be ecumenical. Then we can maybe put this issue behind us because it's an important issue as far as I'm concerned. It says, the Quran says, truly those believers in this message, that means the message given to Prophet Muhammad, as well as the Jews, the Christians, and the Sabians, whoever believes in God and the last day and does righteous deeds will have their reward from their Lord and will not have fear, nor will they grieve. We're talking here, the Quran here is naming the Jews, the Christians, the Sabians, whoever believes in God, doesn't have to have a religion. Whoever believes in God and in the last day and does righteous deeds will have their rewards from their Lord and will not have fear, nor will they grieve. If this is not inclusive, I don't know what is. And this is Surah 2, verse 62. If somebody like to take a note and review it, Surah 2, verse 62. Then in another place, it says, he has sent down the book to you with the truth to confirm what is available of other revelations, as it is he who sent down the Torah and the gospel beforehand and guidance to people, and he revealed the standard by which we judge right from wrong. The Quran here is confirming the Torah and the gospels. I mean, Islam is not a religion that negate, that reject those other religions. It's a religion that came to confirm them. Somebody, an intelligent person, would say, well, why did they come then? They came because, I mean, the Quran came because it's a commentary on these books, not because it is a separate religion that has nothing to do with the previous Abrahamic religion. See, the Quran here is confirming the teaching of Jesus. Some people believe that the gospel is Jesus. In other words, every word that Jesus uttered is gospel. I believe that too. Now, it's also confirming the Torah. The Torah is what God revealed to Moses, the first five books of the Old Testament, so-called Old Testament. I mean, the minute we call it Old Testament, we're insulting the Jews, by the way. So keep that in mind. But the Quran here is coming to say these books are revealed from God. And God revealed to you this message basically to tell the followers of the Torah and the gospel where they were right and where we think they deviated. Not to tell them they're condemned, but to try to tell them, please purify your faith. God is one. Don't make partners with him. Don't try to write, to get your rabbis to write explanation and then call it holy. What's holy is in those five books. So it's a commentary on the Torah and the Gospels. Can I read some more stuff, or is this enough?
If you would like to read more stuff, go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. Why do they come to you? God is telling Prophet Muhammad, why do they come to you for judgment? Jews used to come to Muhammad because he's known to be a just man and a fair man for judgment. So God is telling him, why do they come to you for judgment? Seeing that they have the Torah with God's law. God is saying they have the Torah and it has my law in it. Even then, they will turn away from your judgment. These are not true believers. They're coming to him to play games with him, basically. They have the Torah. They can go to the Torah and they can find exactly what the judgment should be in that case. But they come into Prophet Muhammad just to tell him, yeah, we love you and all this. But then if they don't like the judgment, well, the Torah says something different. Okay, so basically, there are many, many places where the Quran is confirming those books, is telling the Jews and Christians that they should follow what was revealed to them. And this is it.
Yeah, I want to go to your translation with the 3,000 verses that you relate in the Quran to the Bible.
Yes. But
we don't hear that there are so many references to the Bible in the Quran. And this gets to the ecumenical aspect that you're talking about. But why is this, why did you write this book? Why did you see a need for referring to 3,000 verses in the Quran that are in the Bible?
Yes. To start with, I need to say something. Every translation, any translation, regardless what we're talking about, is the translator's understanding of the text. As such, it cannot be holy. Unless I'm holy, my translation is not holy. Mm-hmm. So the same apply to King James, the same apply to my translation of the Quran, and every translation. Usually, a translator is influenced by his environment, by the idiosyncrasies in his environment, by what people like and dislike in his environment. I think I am the same way. I'm not an exception of that rule. I am an Arab American Muslim who lives in the United States in the post 9/11 era. And that's what influenced probably my translation. I wanted to do this translation in order to put in front of my of other Americans, basically what I believe the Quran truly says about itself. You know, I heard all kind of quotation from here and there about what the Quran says, and I didn't like. So I did a translation basically because what was quoted is not what I knew to be the Quran. Other translations are not always fair. They're not always reflecting what the Quran says. There is one translation, for instance, called the Noble Quran. It's printed in Saudi Arabia, and it was distributed by the millions around the world. Right now, imams in various mosques reject it. They wrote the Saudi embassy and said, don't send it anymore. We don't want it. So in that translation, the minute you open the translation, the first surah, which is Al-Fatiha, the one I read or we read in every prayer, it says, guide us to the right path, the path of those that you're not angry with. That translation immediately put between brackets, like the Jews who did this, that, and the other. And not those who went astray, between brackets, like the Christians who did this, that, and the other. God doesn't say that in the Quran. The Quran doesn't say this. But if somebody who does not know and who has a tendency to find something wrong with Islam and Muslims, read it, he will immediately say, this book is anti-humanity. This book is preaching hatred, you know. So I did a translation to show what I believe the Quran is truly saying. By the way, my translation is not what I like to write, regardless what the Arabic says. It is a faithful translation to the Arabic. I mean faithful. Some words took me 3 years to translate, because I wasn't sure of the correct translations. So, this is why I did the translation. Basically, I'm a bridge builder. I want people to live together in peace. I want people to live together as neighbors. I feel Jesus is smiling on me every time I make peace between two people that are fighting. You know, this is me. And by the way, I'm not merging Christianity and Islam in any way, shape, or form. I'm a practicing Muslim. I'm not a Christian.
Right. Yeah.
I follow Jesus. Because I'm a Muslim, I cannot be a Muslim unless I believe in Jesus.
Yeah.
There is not one word that Jesus said that contradicts the Quran, by the way.
Yeah.
The contradiction came in the doctrines later, after Jesus went up to heaven. But what Jesus said has no contradiction with anything in the Quran.
Yeah, I've heard that in order to be a Muslim, you have to love Jesus. Jesus is one of the three greatest prophets in Islam.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. So what you wrote this book with the 3,000 references with a Christian, David Hungerford.
Yes.
And this is just a model of how to be an interreligious dialogue, this book that you put together. It's just a beautiful thing. So yeah. I also wanted to go back to Muhammad and also these 3,000 verses. A lot of the verses in the Torah and in Christian scriptures and in Islam are related to justice. And when we think of justice, at least when I think of justice, I automatically think of, oh, I need to get what's what I deserve, what's right for me. Whereas in what Muhammad is doing, what the Christian scriptures and what the Torah is doing is changing that understanding of justice so that it's not about you, but it's about caring for the needs of specifically the poor, the weak, and the marginalized. And this, I would imagine, is a lot of the 3,000 verses that are going on between these texts.
Well, you know, Adam, if we wanted to make them 10,000 verses, we would have found 10,000 verses. But we had to stop somewhere.
Right.
The truth is, there are a lot of similarity. A lot of similarity. You know, I think we started the process, and it's up to people to continue and to take it further. You know, it's this is just the beginning. It's not the end of the process. I just want to say a couple of words about love and justice. I think it will help people to hear it. It's my own theory. Jesus said one of the two greatest commandments is to love your neighbor like yourself. Now, I can love one neighbor and then the next neighbor and the third neighbor. Suppose I love five neighbors. And then I see that number three is taking advantage of number four. How do I practice loving these two? By showing number four what he's doing wrong to number three, and that's called justice. Justice is love in a societal situation.
And this
justice is the other side of love.
Yeah, and this is what the Prophet Muhammad is doing. All those 14 years in Mecca?
Well, actually, Prophet Muhammad was trying to treat everybody with love and understanding. In those 13 years in Mecca, his humanity was shown more than once in the Quran. He make a mistake somewhere and God immediately reprimand him, immediately, and it's in the Quran. Like one day a blind man came to talk to him, and he was talking to a wealthy man, and he wanted the wealthy man to finish hearing him, and the blind poor man was pulling on his clothes. So I think he wasn't very nice to him. And immediately the Holy Spirit, which in Islam is the Archangel Gabriel, came to him with a revelation, reprimanding him, saying, do you think it's up to you who you will get guidance from us? It's up to us to guide people. So pay attention to the one who is already guided, not the one that you hope to guide. So, I mean, all this is there in the Quran. If you read my translation, you will see it in simple, easy to read, easy to understand English that will be accessible for anybody. It's written really with high school English.
I love it. I love it. We've got, I meant to ask this earlier. We've got one question in the chat room, and that is about ISIS. And we've talked about how Islam, God says, I do not love the aggressor. And this is, that puts ISIS in context for me. But do you have any thoughts about ISIS?
Yes. In the Middle East, there are all kind of theories about ISIS. Basically, ISIS is almost over. What happened in Iraq is that the Iraqi army almost kicked them out of Mosul. And then suddenly we see this movement slowing down. I just don't understand how they can kick them out of Mosul so quickly and then not chase them through the desert to finish them. I mean, between Mosul and Syria, where they're going, there is nothing but a desert. You can hunt them like some people hunt deers from a helicopter, but we're not doing that. Nobody's doing that. Not even Russia is doing that. So, as far as I'm concerned, they're nothing they've done is Islamic. Nothing they've done approach anything that we discussed today. They're not like me. I'm not like them. We don't share the same faith. So just because they are there and they claim to be Muslims, maybe they are Muslims like them. But I don't know those Muslims. I didn't grow up in a household like this. Where I come from in Beirut, Lebanon, people are not like that. You know, so I don't know where those people come from. So basically, internationally, I think their game is over with right now. So I think probably in a few months they will be done with. So ISIS is not important anymore. Their ideology is. We need to be careful. We need to be careful not to put too much pressure on American Muslim, making them feel oppressed, because we will be as if we will be making a wish that will come through. You put too much pressure on somebody, they're bound to something will give, you know. So treat your neighbors with love, with understanding. Don't treat them by oppressing them, putting them down, and scapegoating them.
I think it's a great point that it's the ideology, because first it's the Taliban, it moves to another group, it moves to another group, now it's ISIS, and we keep having to deal with this. And what we need to do is deal with the ideology more than the group. Yes, deal with the group, but getting rid of the group is not going to destroy the ideology. We need to.
It's not a war situation. War will not end the ideology. We need to treat the Muslim world fairly. I don't know why we're still sitting in Afghanistan. We need to move out of Afghanistan. We went to Iraq. We destroyed Iraq, but we didn't put it back together. Why did we have a Marshall Plan for Europe and we don't have any help for Iraq or Tunisia, which deserve tremendous help? Tunisia has a democracy. We kept telling them democracy, democracy. They decided to separate religion from state. And now we don't even go to give them any money to build the economy. So democracy doesn't put food on the table.
Right.
You need investments to put food on the table.
Yep. We're coming down to the last couple of minutes, and I wanted to end with this question, unless Suzanne, feel free to come in at any time if there are questions in the chat room that you want to get in. But Safi, you dedicate your book to grandchildren and their generation. And we talked a little bit about hope for future generations earlier. But I wanted to end with this question about hope, because you also have a Huffington Post article that I'll link to in the show notes when I post this on our website. And in that article, you talk about we now have the capacity to wipe one another off of this planet. So there's this very real warning that you're giving. And where do you find hope in this tension?
I find hope in God. I believe that God is love, is mercy, is understanding. I don't think God created us so we can wipe out each other. I think eventually, if we spread good examples around, if we show our neighbors love despite hatred, things will happen. You know, so at least I try to be the change that I am preaching. So maybe one day there will be 100 person, Christian, Muslim, Jews, all loving their neighbors with devotion, without any particular hope for anything except to please our Creator and to live together in peace.
I love it. Thank you so much, Safi, for being here. You are a light shining in this world, and you give me hope. So thank you so much for spending this time with us today.
Thank you.
I've already got one comment. Hopefully you can have Safi back. I've really enjoyed this, and I've enjoyed it too. Would love to have you back. There's so much that I feel like we could talk about. So if people want to keep up with Safi, you can find him on Facebook and on Twitter. And on his website, safikaskis.com. You can find his translations of the Quran on Amazon. And you can like their Facebook pages on Facebook. And as always, you can keep up with The Raven Review at theravenfoundation.org on our Facebook page and Twitter accounts. And thank you, everybody, for joining us, for your comments and questions in the chat room. And Safi, have a great rest of the evening. Hopefully we can do this again sometime soon.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you, Adam. Awesome. Bye-bye.
Well, until next time, grace and peace be with you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.